Hey guys, how's it going? I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I guess it's time for me to write a blog entry about today on the show. Man, I gotta get in the hang of doing a show in the morning again. The start of the show, it's so soon. You know, 11 o'clock. It might as well be 6 in the morning. Well, so far I only have one guest lined up, but I'm working on it. We may have some others. But the one guest that we definitely have today, Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy Newspapers, you're going to want to hear what he's got to say. Actually, you're going to not want to hear what he has to say, but in that horrible, masochistic, anti-war, libertarian, but must know the truth kind of way that we have about us. You will want to hear it anyway. You will love it and hate it, and you will love hating it, and you will be freaking out. I'm freaking out. I don't know. You might not be freaking out. I'm freaking out because I think, it's almost time for the next war to start. Bad times. And you know, the thing of it is that so far, the president doesn't seem to want to do it. And the Congress, which is worse than the president on almost everything as far as, being warmongers, they are such traitors to America that they're actually right now, I won't say for peace, but they're not pushing for a reinvasion of Iraq. They're not pushing for massive strikes, I don't think, or maybe kind of on the margins it's beginning to creep through. And the only explanation I have is the same thing that I told you yesterday. I think that they actually just are so beholden to Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel's policy that not Sunni radical extremist Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and al-Nusra warriors are the threat, but that Hezbollah is the threat, because Hezbollah is backed by Syria, is backed by Iran, and never mind backed by Iraq, because that was Israel's idea that America overthrow Saddam in favor of the Supreme Islamic Council in the damn first place. So the fact that all the land, at least from Baghdad to Basra, counts as part of that Shiite crescent, you won't hear that in the talking point, but it's true. It was the Israel firsters who made it that way. But so now, they're so damned concerned about Hezbollah on their northern border there in southern Lebanon. And this is what the Clean Break says back in 1996. It says, we hate Hezbollah so much that we think that America ought to invade Iraq for us. Because once we get rid of Saddam, then that'll weaken Syria and weaken their support for Hezbollah. I'm not saying that they're smart or know what the hell they're doing. I'm just saying that's what they think they're doing. And so anyway, here you got Washington, D.C. is so beholden to the government in Jerusalem that they won't come out and attack Obama for being weak on the Al-Qaeda issue. They won't come out and say, I mean, can you imagine the Republican demagoguery? If Israel wasn't an issue, if our war on their behalf against the Shiites was not an issue, can you imagine the demagoguery that would be going on right now from the halls of all the Republicans and right-wing talk radio and everything else about how there's literally an Al-Qaeda state being built in Iraq, where the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria is no longer the name of a group, it's actually the name of a place now. I mean, you might have been wondering. You might have scratched a hole in your head trying to figure out, where are the Republican warmongering demagogues on this? Oh, they're traitors. They're such traitors to America. They put their loyalty to Israel so far ahead of America's that they can't even be bothered to be a warmonger on the Al-Qaeda issue. Holy crap. I think this is the only one time I can think of in my whole life where I've been grateful for the Israel lobby for being so horrible and for demanding such loyalty from their horrible sock puppets in the Republican and Democratic parties in the Congress, and I don't mean to just pick on the Republicans, sorry, but usually, you know, they like to attack Obama for being too weak. That's kind of their shtick, no matter who he kills or how. But anyway, still, it's the dissonance, the same dissonance in this narrative that I've been harping on for 3 years now. And I'm sorry to say I told you so. I know it sounds terrible, but I'm just saying that's what I've kind of been telling you is Al-Qaeda in Iraq, bad. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, in Syria, okay. We're backing them there while we're still fighting them over here. And what the hell is going on? And because of that dissonance in the policy, because of how little sense it makes from any kind of point of view that could be explained on TV by these people, you know, that would have to omit by necessity that, well, we care more about Hezbollah, Israel's enemy, than Al-Qaeda, the American people's enemy, that the American government made for them in the first place, of course, but still. They don't want to have to explain that. So they just stick with, gotta back the rebels. Susan Rice just announced more help for the rebels the other day. Boy, you know, the critics are right that we should be sending them more military equipment, not just non-lethal stuff, at the very same time that their gains are being doubled and quadrupled in Iraq. And here's my thing, and I'm going to learn a lot from Mitchell Prothero here, and so are you, in a little while, but I don't think that the Iraqi government, now maybe Sunni tribal leaders and former Baathists and you know, religious authorities, grassroots Iraqi Sunni leaders, they may well have the authority to cancel ISIS's gains the way they did in 06 and 07 with the so-called awakening. But I don't know if they want to do that. And I I do not believe that the Iraqi government, even if they were backed up by American drones, you know, fleets of American drones, I don't think the Iraqi army has the ability to take the Anbar province back at all. I mean, what's going on in Fallujah, by the way? And they've basically been outside of Iraqi government authority for a while here, right? They've just been under siege, getting blasted with howitzers every once in a while. But there's no real government control there. I don't know if there's ISIS control there either, but, you know, I guess the clean break is complete. Iraq has been smashed. This is what they call expediting the chaotic collapse so that we can better determine what takes place later. And I don't think it really worked out the way they wanted. It's sort of like the Emperor in the Star Wars prequels. He never gets it exactly how he wants, but it ends up working out for him anyway. It's kind of the same sort of thing. The neocons, it didn't go exactly as they planned, but did they still turn the Middle East into a boiling cauldron of death and pain and extremism and still floods of American weapons and tax dollars to the Israelis and all their enemies weaken and all that? Yep. They still got everything they wanted. And anyway, so this is the one and only time you'll hear me praising the Israel lobby, and it sure is faint praise indeed. They demand such treachery on the part of our political leaders that they can't be bothered to be honest about what the crisis is in Iraq and Syria right now. And if they were, they would be pro-war. So it's the, you know, the treachery the Israelis demand is what's preventing America from reinvading Iraq and invading Syria right now. That's what I think. That's my little essay. I'm not very eloquent, but I'm right about everything. I need to really, like, go to the university and take a couple vocabulary classes or something. I ain't too good at talking, but I'm right. But here's the thing, and I think that this is what we're going to learn from Mitchell Prothero coming up here, is that the size of this crisis is too big to be ignored. And the dissonance in the narrative that Al-Qaeda in Iraq bad, Al-Qaeda in Iraq in Syria good, I think that's going to go away. The truth is just too powerful for the Israel first narrative to withstand it. And so that means I still stand by my prediction that this is the next war, and I don't think it'll wait till Hillary and Jeb. I think Barack Obama is going to have to launch at least fleets of drones and have to, not by my standard, but by the Empire's standard, drones and probably Marines to go and fight in the new Islamic State.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact: there's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah: turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We got Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy Newspapers coming up, reporting on all the advances of ISIS in Iraq and Syria lately. A couple important pieces here from McClatchy Newspapers by him and others. And, you know, that's one of the other emails I have out is to his colleague, Nancy Youssef, and she's really great, and I think reports from Cairo semi-permanently, regularly, anyway, and I sure would like to talk with her about Egypt, follow up on some of what we learned from Adam Morrow the other day. She's a really great reporter. So anyway, that could happen. And then also I'm trying to get Daniel Larrison and a couple others. Actually, I'm not. Gage is. I have a new assistant, a volunteer assistant on the show helping me get the guests. So I've got Gage working on it. Let's hope that works out. I think it just might. All right, now, very briefly, let me direct your attention towards scotthorton.org/books. It's quite incomplete. And yeah, my server's a little slow, but I'm getting a new one very soon, so it'll go faster for you. But anyway, man, I compiled this giant list of books long ago, and I never have had a chance to put it to use. And now, finally, I have. And I think it's fair to say mostly it's stuff I've read and a lot of stuff that I wish I'd read. And I spent hours and hours last night populating that bookstore in the back end of scotthorton.org, the database, blah, 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 and I'm about halfway done. And then when I'm done, then I got to start thinking of all the other stuff that's not even on the list and keep going from there. So it's going to be as extensive a recommended reading site as I could possibly make for you. And then it'll be the Amazon deal with the kickback there if you want to learn a lot and see me make 50 cents per book, too, or whatever, then that's cool, too. So that's at scotthorton.org/books. Again, I'm only just getting started. I haven't even put the live link up at the top of the front page yet because, well, I ain't even near done. But there's already a ton of great stuff in there, so. Oh, and then, you know, eventually you'll be able to categorize it by war or, you know, whatever subject or by author. Right now, they're in the order that I put them in there in, which is a little bit jumpy aroundy. But anyway, scotthorton.org/books. And then as you read them, you'll be able to say to yourself, I don't think Scott ever read this one. Or Scott definitely read this one because I hear him plagiarizing it out loud all the time. Or, you know, whatever. Oh, speaking of plagiarism, as long as I'm wasting time here talking about websites and plagiarism, haha, did you see where Christopher Ketchum, our dear old friend Christopher Ketchum, who we here at the Scott Horton Show love to little pieces, Christopher Ketchum wrote this great thing, completely exploding Chris Hedges' career. Haha, you suck, Chris Hedges, you commie rat. And now, Christopher Ketchum has busted Chris Hedges acting as though other people's intellectual property is his common property. like the commie rat he is. Now, don't get me wrong, because I don't really believe in intellectual property. I don't think that plagiarism is a crime, but I do think it's a sin. I do think it's mean and ugly for Chris Hedges to copy and paste passages from Ernest Hemingway and pretend like he wrote them. And then you go picking on Petra Bartsiewicz, or whatever, this incredible journalist. She's so good. And in fact, the best thing that she ever read, I remember even wrote that I know of. I remember where I was when I read it. It was in Harper's Magazine, and it was all about this lady in Pakistan who had clearly been falsely accused of these horrible crimes and renditioned off to God knows what hell and this and that. And he copied it right out of Harper's Magazine. And this is then the magazine that he goes to publish a story about poverty in Camden, New Jersey. And it turns out major pieces of his story are outright copied and pasted from the guy at Reuters. Or worse, actually goes in there and changes that to witch and whatever, which just goes to prove how guilty he is, deliberately plagiarizing and trying to pretend that he's not by giving it a light redo. Well, Petra Bartsiewicz, I'm sorry, Petra, I don't know how to say your damn last name right. Her husband is Christopher Ketchum. And that guy wields a pen like a sword, and he will destroy you. And so destroyed you are, Christopher Hedges, in the pages of Harper's today. And it's funny, too, because he even has quotes from Hedges saying, oh, yeah, well, I guess, you know, Christopher Ketchum has a lot to gain by shooting up at a higher-ranking left-wing writer than him, blah, blah. Oh, yeah, that must be what's going on. He's jealous of you, huh? Chris Hedges, who lied us into war with Iraq by pretending that Saddam and Osama were friends. You got a million people killed with your crappy commie propaganda in the New York Times, and now you want to pretend Christopher Ketchum is jealous of you? And then at the end of the Harper's article, Christopher Ketchum says, hey, listen, I recognize plainly that the Nation Institute that has backed my work before probably never will again, and the Nation Magazine that's published me before probably never will again now, and I realize that I'm burning bridges probably with Truth Out and Truth Dig and Common Dreams and all the other publications that are cited here as places where Chris Hedges has been plagiarizing, and so, you know, that's tough, I guess, but here's the truth about him. There it is in Harper's. Oh, yeah, I guess Christopher Ketchum thought this would be a great way to get ahead, huh, by shooting up at such a legendary hero like commie Chris Hedges, who lied us into war with Iraq and killed a million people and turned half the country over to Iran and the other half over to Ayman al-Zawahiri. Great job, Chris. I guess Christopher Ketchum is just jealous of you, which is how he keeps catching you lifting other people's work, including his wife's. Haha, including Ernest Hemingway. I love the part where he's talking with this guy who's like, you know, I'm reading War is a Force, which gives us meaning. And I'm thinking, what a great book. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, this paragraph sounds familiar to me. I think it's from A Farewell to Arms by Ernest Hemingway. Oh, you almost got me, Chris Hedges. Except that I think that's from A Farewell to Arms by Ernest Hemingway. Well, you know how them commie Marxist types are, that what's theirs is theirs and what's yours is theirs. And so there he goes, copying and pasting Hemingway, copying and pasting Ahmed Chalabi, copying and pasting the great Petra Bartsiewicz. And then now today he's gotten took. He's been smashed, destroyed, had his career exploded permanently by the great Christopher Ketchum. Get him, Chris. I mean, good Chris. Back with Mitchell Prothero in just a sec. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves.
It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest today is Mitchell Prothero. He's a reporter for McClatchy Newspapers, McClatchyDC.com. I think now in Turkey, but reporting on Lebanon, Syria, etc. The Sham, as some call it, I guess. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Mitchell?
I'm doing pretty good today. How's our sound levels doing?
You sound just fine.
Okay, great.
Yeah, good times. Appreciate you joining us here today. Bad times. You have so much news to report here. Let me just stand out of your way. You give us the rundown, and then it may not be till the second segment that I get to start with my follow-up questions. There's so much going on with the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria.
Yeah, it's really been a remarkable week on that front. I mean, going into this week, we knew that they were a powerful group controlling a big chunk of eastern Syria, limited for the most part around eastern Aleppo and Raqqa, and that they'd been conducting operations, you know, in various incarnations for the last 10 years in Iraq. What nobody really saw coming was a massive conventional attack on Iraq's second largest city that was, I guess, so intimidating that the Iraqi army and police just threw down their guns and ran. So essentially, they've driven to within about 60 miles of Baghdad now. You could safely say the Iraqi state is in disarray, if not on the verge of complete collapse. And at this stage, we're seeing militias step in from both the Kurdish side and from the Shia militias that at times battled the United States off and on throughout the U.S. occupation are stepping in to essentially stop them from reaching the capital. It's a very fluid situation, and it's incredibly difficult to get your head around.
All right, now... So now one big difference between a town like Mosul and Iraq is that Iraq is now a super duper majority Shiite city because of the American war there. And so I guess the question is not so much whether they could really take Baghdad, but whether they could take the army that's protecting Baghdad, whether the Iraqi army has the wherewithal to stand up to them, even back in Baghdad, much less way out on the frontier, so-called, out in Mosul, right?
Well, it's even gotten so much closer at this stage that you could argue that within 60 miles of the Baghdad city limits is where we're seeing some clashes now.
So where's that? That's like Abu Ghraib neighborhood, right?
Well, that's in that direction. They've been in Abu Ghraib, actually. That's to the west. A little bit of history here. One, earlier this year, there was an uprising in the Anbar province, Fallujah and Ramadi, which may be familiar historically to your listeners, just because the U.S. fought, you know, some terrible insurgencies there against a lot of the very same guys we're seeing rising up against the Iraqi government. Those cities essentially fell as a result of the fighting that was going on in Syria. Parts of them are still slightly under the control of the central government buildings sort of in the center of town. But the countryside and huge swaths, and we're talking millions of people, have more or less been under the what we call the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or I'm just starting to call the Islamic State, because they're practically a country at this stage, as well as, you know, tribes that have been irritated by the Shia government in Baghdad. You're right when you say that the Shia had essentially taken over Iraq after the United States invasion and occupation, in part just because there were more or less fair elections, and Shia compose about 60% of the population of Iraq, with about 20% Kurds and 20% Sunnis, or Sunni Arabs. So what had happened was they fought a nasty sectarian war for control of Baghdad between about 2000 late 5, early 6, and 2008, that the Shia more or less won. They drove huge amounts of Sunnis out of their neighborhoods, pushed them sort of into the western side of the city. And at that point, you saw a lot of the violence in Iraq calm down simply because the Shia were firmly in command. They kept rolling with that and had essentially taken over the country. And since the U.S. left in 2010, there hadn't been any real motivation on the part of Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister, and the Shia to share any kind of power. And so they were taking revenge for both, you know, the sort of the oppression that had happened under Saddam. They were rewarding their followers through patronage and jobs in the ministries. You know, finally, we're in charge of the money here. We're going to make sure our people who'd been oppressed and sort of shoved aside for 40 odd years, make sure they get paid here. And also, you know, a little revenge for the civil war that they essentially fought with the U.S. as a referee. Well, the Sunnis are not happy about this. And the minute that the Islamic State guys, who are what we're calling a proto-Islamic caliphate, they're really even, you know, as some might say, a little crazier than Al-Qaeda. They've been kicked out of Al-Qaeda for brutality and for trying to bring an Islamic State at a time that virtually even the Al-Qaeda guys thinks it's inappropriate. And they've just gone on their own. They're their own thing now. And once they attacked Mosul, what we're seeing more and more of is that the Sunnis, who've been so marginalized over the last 4 to 10 years, have risen up along with them. So even guys who wouldn't ordinarily subscribe to an Al-Qaeda ideology are taking up arms to fight against the Shia-dominated government in Baghdad. You are right, though. I think it would be a stretch to think that this offensive could take a city of 8 million people that's had five days to prepare. The supply lines are a lot longer. But just about everything north of it right now is in flux, except for the Kurdish areas. The Kurds have a very professional security force. They're U.S. trained. They're very, very well motivated and have a tendency to, as we used to joke, carry medical packs and hold guns with both hands, which makes them elite troops on some level in Iraq. And those guys don't screw around. They've already pushed out. So we haven't seen ISIS or the Sunni uprising willing to really face off with the Kurds at all. They've been concentrating on pushing south towards Baghdad and grabbing as much of that Sunni triangle as possible to connect with what they've already got in Fallujah and Ramadi, which is starting to look like, I don't know, a third of the country.
Right. Yeah, well, God, there's so much to go back over here. But on that note, you know, it's been, I don't know, 5 or 6 weeks now since the State Department report came out. And I interviewed your colleague, Jonathan Landay, who is a very sober guy. I mean, I've been speaking with him for years, and he's a very sober-minded guy. And he was saying, look, it's not a proto-state. It is a state, okay? It's a country now. It's not a lawless Wild West, would-be Jihadistan. It is Jihadistan. It is a country now.
Landy's 100% right on that. It's something that I've been pushing now because we've been trying to explain what ISIS is throughout all of my coverage of Syria. And what we said was first they were Al-Qaeda-affiliated and inspired, and then they were sort of a rogue Al-Qaeda offshoot. But now we just got to call it the Islamic State. That's what they are. They took the central bank in Mosul. Nobody really wants to tell us exactly how much money was in that bank. But one estimate I've seen is 400 million U.S. In Iraqi currency, plus unknown amounts of foreign reserves and gold bullion. So whatever the number is, I think it's safe to say at this stage, they've got more Iraqi money than they can ever really realistically spend. Certainly enough to pay all the civil servants in Mosul for, I don't know, the next year or longer. And they're by far, I mean, even if the lowest estimates that I've heard rumors of, because I don't want to commit to a number because we're not reporting that, I don't really know. But I can't imagine even the lowest estimate wouldn't make them the best funded non-state actor in the world.
Right.
And at some point, you've got to make them a state actor. I mean, they control oil fields. They have taken a power plant. They're about to take over. In fact, I'm surprised they haven't done it yet. I think they're afraid of damaging the equipment, but they're about to take over the largest oil refinery in Iraq. They run their own courts. They have their own police. I don't think it's anything that your listeners would be in a huge hurry to immigrate to.
Right.
But it's definitely, at this point, the formation of what we're calling a nascent, you know, proto-Islamic caliphate.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. It's not just that they have the authority to keep Assad's troops out or something like that. They're providing the water and the electricity and the local dispute resolution systems, like you're talking about, the local court systems, this kind of thing. They really are building a country here. And
they're doing a lot of it. And they're being sort of rewarded right now by the people.
Right. I'm sorry. I gotta go out to this break, Mitchell. Hold it right there. We'll be right back, everybody, with Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy Newspapers with some answers about the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one.
But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Mitchell Prothero. Writing for McClatchyDC.com. Thank you very much, Mitchell, for holding through the break there and staying on with us. As you know, you're one of the few who's covering this kind of thing. Well, I mean, maybe now it's the big story of the week, but up until now, you're one of the few paying very close attention to this. So I really appreciate your journalism and your time on the show. And now I'm going to say some things that I take responsibility for any errors. I'll ask for your correction, but I want to give credit to your colleague, or at least former colleague David Enders, to Patrick Coburn and others for who I believe I'm paraphrasing. During the Iraq War, the Sunni-based insurgency was really the entire Sunni community of Iraq. They had everything to lose by losing Baghdad and losing the control of the government. You had former Ba'athists, Sunni imams, and tribal leaders, family, you know, elders, and these kinds of people. They controlled the insurgency. Al-Qaeda was about 2 or 3%, Zarqawi's group, and they were useful, and actually not really, but they were thought to be useful for a time. They were probably more harm than good for the Sunni insurgency, and they eventually cut their losses and attacked them and marginalized them and kept them down for quite a while, and even gave, you know, Petraeus a little breathing room to declare a victory and go ahead and get out of there. In Syria, this has really always been their war. This is not the Sunni-based insurgency. At least substantial proportions of the Sunni majority, and they're the 70% majority in Syria, unlike the 20% minority in Iraq, as you said. But still, substantial proportions of Sunnis in Syria seem to prefer Assad, or at least to sit this thing out, and not so. It's not so much just a clear sectarian split in the war there. It's much more just al-Nusra and ISIS's war, and the so-called moderates are widely rumored but seldom touched or seen. It seems like all the support goes to these very same extremists. We call them al-Qaeda, the bad guys in Iraq, but they're the rebels in Syria. And so now that we see, and there's obviously a few different places you could go with this discussion too, but now we see ISIS coming in and, you know, walking right in to Mosul like this. I wonder if you, or if there's even enough indication to know yet, or if you have an opinion on whether they have grown in such strength that it's no longer fair at all to say that they're marginal compared to the Sunni insurgency or the Sunni opposition to Maliki in Iraq compared to the old days, the way it is in Syria. In other words, if the tribal leaders of Mosul decided, okay, you guys are getting a little too big for your britches here, will they even be able to marginalize them as they did back in 06 and 07, if you know what I mean? Or are they really that powerful now that they could walk right into Fallujah tomorrow too, or and stay there?
Well, they've managed to hold Fallujah for 6 months as a coalition.
Well, I mean, I'm sorry. I should say one more thing about that, too. And I'm sorry, because I ask really long questions sometimes. It's not much of a question as much of my best understanding for you to correct. But I seem to remember that they flew the black flag in Fallujah, and some local tribal leaders told them, take that thing down, and they took it down. Because it really was much more a tribal thing than an al-Qaeda thing. But I don't know how to parse this stuff that much, you know.
Well, one thing is, and we all got to get into the practice of, we need to get away from the Qaeda thing at this stage, because like I said, these guys have transcended that stuff. You know, the joke is that they're not Qaeda, they're actually worse, you know, depending on your perspective. Just to go back a couple of things that you said,
sure.
There was a Free Syrian Army. There is still one. They were very powerful in the early days of the Syrian Revolution, and a lot of them got killed. Fighting pretty bravely, you know, to overthrow Assad. And they did have a vision for a state that probably we would have all been a little more comfortable with than what's been happening. But at a certain point, the Islamists did arrive and really marginalized them. And a lot of the FSA guys, you know, turned out to be gangsters, turned out to be sort of in it for the money, and they basically fell apart. But even today on the ground, my guess would be there's still more of those guys than there are Nusra and ISIS in Syria, but they're just having a very difficult time. The regime has been better armed. Iran has flooded the zone with as much money, fuel, and weapons as the regime could ever need. And with Hezbollah fighting on the side of the regime, they're about the most professional and effective military force in the Arab world. They've just had a terrible time of it. And then they got attacked from behind, basically, by ISIS. So, you know, I do disparage them frequently as hotel revolutionaries, as being somewhat incompetent, but they really were important early on. But we've seen, like we did in Iraq, we saw that this insurgency transform into an Islamic one. I would agree with all of my colleagues about Iraq, and I was there during this time. It did not start as something that you'd call particularly Islamic or Islamist, we should say, in nature. I think most guys were Muslims. But what they were was nationalists, Baathists, a combination of people who, for different motivations, were furious that the U.S. was occupying. But we did see it transform into something along the lines of ISIS. And by 2006 and 2007, they were the most powerful insurgent group. To a large extent, that's why the tribes ended up turning on them. They got sick of being bossed around and told what to do by Yemenis and Saudis and these foreigners. And when the tribes decided they had to go, they went fairly quickly because they were foreigners. And even an incompetent Iraqi is going to be a better fighter than a competent Yemeni if you're in Iraq. And so that's what we don't know yet. We've definitely seen guys in this incarnation of this fight, replacing the Americans with the Shia government, who have joined, who aren't otherwise, you know, prone to supporting Al-Qaeda's, you know, or I should say the Islamic State's ideology, what we'd call Salafi jihadism. But right now, they're all working together. A bunch of us who've been experienced enough in the region would expect that alliance to start to fall apart. When that's going to happen, how that would happen, I don't exactly know. And I think it's probably early to think about that. What we're really faced with now is the collapse of a central government in Iraq, collapse of their security forces, and everybody reverting to the militias of 2006. Mm-hmm. So what I think you're going to end up seeing is Iran-backing militias, Asiya al-Haq, Jaish al-Mahdi. I don't know if they're going to come back in the same form they were when we fought them, you know, when the Americans fought them in, you know, the early days of the occupation. The Badr organization, I think the Iranian Revolutionary Guard is going to end up flooding operatives into Iraq if they're not already there in order to try to stop this thing before it gets to Baghdad.
Right.
But at this stage, I think that, like I said, the capital's not going to fall, but I do think you're going to see everything north of it balkanize into areas controlled by different parties. And at that stage, it's kind of the end of the modern state of Iraq.
Well, you know, it sure seems to me like Ayman al-Zawahiri really blew it from a, you know, kind of, well, I was going to say public relations, but that's not really it. Like the so-called chain of command, he had these ISIS and Nusra and everybody else had sworn their loyalty to him. And then he ordered ISIS out of Syria and into Iraq. And they said, well, what are you going to do? Court-martial us from your basement in Pakistan, old man, or whatever. And they went ahead and did what they wanted anyway. And yet here you see that they're perfectly happy to go back and forth and go and fight in Iraq. And now look at these huge gains in Iraq. And they didn't do it because he said so. They did it because they wanted to. He's a couple thousand miles to the east of there. And so he could still be the, you know, rhetorical and proverbial king of Al-Qaeda, but he's just basically marginalized himself right out of business, it looks like.
Well, one, people are only going to follow you if you give them strong ideology and leadership or money and guns. And he's in a little bit of a difficult position because he's not very charismatic like bin Laden was. And he's running for his life, we assume, in Pakistan. So he's not in a position to drop $100 million on these guys to get them going. So why would you listen to somebody who didn't pay you?
Yeah, but there's one silver lining in this, right? Is bad times for Zawahiri, finally.
Yeah, he's had a rough run of it for a while now, but yeah, absolutely. The biggest mistake, I think, in some ways, that these guys made, the Qaeda guys, in terms of holding everything together, is that they forgot one of their own core principles when they ordered ISIS out of Syria, which is that they approached this whole thing as, and one of the ISIS slogans is no nationalism, no tribalism, only the caliphate. And even if you ask him, Bin Laden, Zawahiri, and these guys, they all believe this stuff too on some level, which is that there is no such thing as Syria. There is no such thing as Iraq, Lebanon, Turkey. These are, you know, all parts of a broader Muslim state that got carved up by colonial Europeans in order to keep them down. So in essence, the minute he told them to all go back to Iraq, he was recognizing a paradigm that they were supposed to be trying to overthrow in the first place. And so the ISIS guy seized on that and just said, look, this guy's for political power. He's not for what we're fighting for, which is a state that does away with all of this silly stuff. Because there shouldn't be a difference between Baghdad and Damascus, Palestine, in their view, you know, Al-Quds, Cairo. This is all the same country.
All right. Now, is there any chance that you're just doing nothing and would love to do one more segment with us here, or do I need to let you go?
I do one more segment.
Oh, man, and now I can't even hear. For some reason, Skype doesn't work with the bumper music. They conflict in the mixing board or something. Let's type to each other during the break. Mitchell Prothero, everybody, from McClatchy, D.C. We may have him in the next segment. Maybe not. I'm not sure yet. We'll be right back, though. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, guys. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I've got Mitchell Prothero on the line. He's an investigative journalist, a war reporter for McClatchy newspapers, McClatchyDC.com. Iraqi government asks U.S. to bomb Islamist fighters as 30,000 troops flee their posts. Oh, my God. Some answers about the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. No longer the name of a fruity little club, now literally the name of a place on the map. They've even got bulldozers. Unconfirmed pictures seem pretty confirmative to me. They're bulldozing the dirt berm that demarcated the Sykes-Picot line between Iraq and Syria. It's over. The Islamo-fascist caliphate that always was just the Bush administration's fantasy is now coming to life in real life. It's absolutely amazing. And so I guess there's so much stuff to talk about, but back to the question of whether they're going to try to take Baghdad or not, and how during the war, the Americans helped the Shiites not just come to power in the election and all that, but really helped them with the sectarian cleansing, the Mahdi army and the Badr brigades of the sectarian cleansing of Baghdad and made it like a 85% Shiite city, something like that. And I remember talking with Patrick Coburn about some of the attacks in Baghdad a few months back, or maybe a year or two ago or something, about, you know, ISIS. And we were talking about how, well, look, if it took the army and the Marines to give Baghdad to the Shiites, then and to whoop al-Qaeda and drive them out, along with the rest of the Sunnis, then they have no hope of taking Baghdad back, and they have to know that, right? And Patrick Coburn said, well, you know, and he kind of confirmed this yesterday on the show as well, from their point of view, they're the super majority in the region. They got Saudi money, and it's the Shiite Arabs who ought to be on the defensive just by numbers, and so they sure would like to have Baghdad back. And so I just wonder whether you think, maybe it's a stupid question, it's just a speculative thing, but I wonder whether you think they really want now to try to restart the whole civil war for Baghdad again, or whether they're going to, you know, continue to focus on Assad in Syria or and consolidate the gains that they've made in the north and west of Iraq right now, or what do you see for the future here?
Well, I mean, on some level, I mean, we can do what would be logical and tactical. And you always have to keep in mind that, you know, this is the Islamic world's equivalent of a bunch of school shooters. So they really might think God has told them it'll all be okay, and they could make some very terrible tactical mistakes.
Right.
One would be trying to fight for Baghdad.
That's what I'm hoping. I mean, no offense to the people of Baghdad, but I don't want them coming west.
Well, that's, I mean, look, the fact is they're not coming in this direction. The fact is, I find it extremely unlikely that they would be capable of taking a city of 8 million people that, for the most part, doesn't want them. particularly when you factor in they've had time now to push up and reconstitute some of these militias that are actually quite experienced and very ruthless. Jaish Mehdi, you know, the Haq guys and, you know, Badr organizations. These guys are getting geared up and organized right now by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. We've got persistent reports that I can't confirm, but I'd be shocked if weren't true, that Qasem Soleimani, who's the head of the Quds Force for Iran, the guy that a lot of people consider having saved the Syrian regime last year, that he's in place right now directing all of this. And like I said, I'd be shocked if he wasn't.
Yeah, and America is sending him some F-16s to help.
Well, that's the funny thing is, at this stage, one, this type of thing makes very strange bedfellows. I had Hezbollah guys telling me a year and a half ago, wait and see. Hezbollah, Iran, America, and Russia are all going to be fighting alongside each other against these crazy Qaeda guys. And we all kind of snickered, and I still think that's unrealistic, but it's a lot less crazy now. The simple fact is, at this stage, American and Iranian strategic interests definitely coincide. I don't see America getting particularly involved in this. One, you know, the Obama administration's made it perfectly clear that they don't really feel like there's a ton that they can do, which I think is a realistic view. There's a tendency by conservatives, I think, to overstate America's influence and ability to do things. And then I think that the left has a tendency to overstate America's ability to screw things up. America really isn't that involved or important to any of these people right now. We can dump more money and weapons into the field, but even if you notice, the statements that have come out of the administration are, this is your problem, guys. We offered to leave a training force back in 2010. Mm-hmm. You and Iran conspired to tell us to get the heck out. And so I think you and Iran look like you're in pretty good shape to handle it, which probably is the smartest thing for the American for American foreign policy to do. I saw a quote earlier today from a guy, an analyst who covers jihadi groups, who I respect a lot, who said, you know, if you think about it, how much influence did the Ottoman Empire have over over Catholic and Protestant sectarian violence in Ireland? Keeping that in mind, what do you think America could do to stop a Sunni-Shia civil war, sectarian war, if both are really intent on having one? And frankly, I think both sides have had it with each other. I think that this has been a long time coming. I think that America screwed around trying to manipulate these tensions for their own gain and really didn't get anywhere with it and have sort of ducked out. And at this stage, what you're seeing is you were sort of right when you said, you know, talking about Saudi, you see a lot of the Gulf states who are Sunnis extremely worried about Iran's influence. Iran is the natural and historical superpower in that region with 77 million people. And, you know, they're Shia and they're kind of all having a reckoning right now that I'm not sure anybody involved really cares what America thinks. The joke is if two groups of people want to kill each other and take each other's stuff, they're not really going to listen to outsiders. Right. You know, so right now, I just don't know what the West could do. I think that Turkey and Iran can get involved. I think that they could probably help put this down fairly quickly if they really threw themselves in. But from what I can tell, it's a regional problem. It's a regional thing that's been coming down the pike for a very long time. And the more the West stays out of it, I think the smarter it would be. I mean, that's editorializing a little bit, but I just can't see what America could do right now, short of dropping 100,000 guys in there who would just end up bogged down in another stupid occupation. And nobody's even suggesting such a thing, except maybe Senator John McCain.
Right. Well, I sure agree with you about, you know, what's possible, what should be done and that kind of thing. But, you know, if we go back to the numbers here and the actual kind of borders and social services and real state being created here, it's just too good of a talking point for not just John McCain, but the whole right wing. And I think actually that because of the kind of Israel influence policy, if I may try to put it politely, of being so hell-bent against Assad and supporting the rebels against Assad this whole time, the dissonance in the narrative has prevented the right wing, who usually are of you know, kind of one narrative attacking Obama for not doing enough in any given situation. They're a little bit torn when they're saying he ought to be backing the rebels more in Syria and doing everything he can to help Maliki crush them in
Iraq when they're the exact same guys. But I think eventually the dissonance in that narrative is going to fall away, and it's going to become too clear to everyone, even at the New America Foundation and wherever, that, you know what, morality aside, as far as what makes sense, we ought to be doing like George W. Bush and paying Assad to kill al-Qaeda guys, not paying al-Qaeda guys to kill Assad. This makes no sense whatsoever. And if there's really a jihadi state there, I don't know how, never mind Hillary or Jeb Bush, I don't know how Obama is going to be able to resist sending in at least fleets of drones, if not Marines, when the reckoning with the old narrative and the new come to, you know, sift out here. You know what I mean?
I had dinner with a spooky sort of Defense Department official who works in the region about 2 months ago. And I asked him that question. I said, you know, at what point do we see the drones in eastern Syria? I mean, you got piles of these guys. They're able to train and do whatever they want. Assad certainly has no interest in taking on ISIS. And we haven't seen much interest by ISIS in taking on Assad. They've been trying to build their own state and clearly had their eyes on Iraq the whole time. He said there's a very motivated government looking to kill them. We don't need to.
Well, hear, hear. That's a great place to end it. Thank you so much for your journalism and your time on the show, Mitchell. I really appreciate it.
No problem at all. Get in touch anytime.
Great, great. That's Mitchell Prothero at McClatchyDC.com. Go and read that. I mean it. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com. Oh, here you go from the Wall Street Journal. Iran deploys forces to fight al-Qaeda-inspired militants in Iraq. Iranian Revolutionary Guard forces helped Iraqi troops win back control of most of Tikrit, the sources say. Huh. I don't know. And that's all I have is the preview. In fact, here, let me see if I can get a good link. I bet I can get Eric Garris to get me a good link for this article here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. The Scott Horton Show. Maybe Mitchell Prothero is right. He sure knows a hell of a lot about this, a hell of a lot more than me about it. And he says that, you know what, they're so busy killing each other over there, they're really not coming this way. I should have really asked him. Sometimes I go on too long. I forget which all points I want to try to get him to hit on there. But one of the things I wanted to talk about was the numbers of Western Europeans who have gone to fight in Syria. And how many of them are going to be able to get back into Western Europe. And how many of them are going to be able to do so without any intelligence agency or national police agency knowing that that's where they just got back from. That, to me, is the big deal. This always happens, man. I'm always too far ahead of everything, and then by the time what I say comes true, nobody remembers anymore. Like, hey, all these al-Qaeda guys fighting in Iraq from Saudi and Libya and Jordan and Syria, they're all going to go home one day, and then what? You know, that was me 10 years ago. Oops. I should have waited for a minute. All this blowback, all the blowback from the war in Syria all this time, it's coming. And so it's just like I said about Libya 3 years ago now. I said, well, now that we've got this war in Libya, that means we'll be there for 30 years. We'll be there forever now. We're never leaving. We're going to have influence. We're going to have strategery. We're going to have stability and counter-terror operations. Just let me know when the first suicide truck bomb goes off, and we'll have a war on terror in Libya forever. And now it's been real slow motion in my prediction coming true, but of course, there ain't no way around it, is there? It's just a matter of logical happenstance and whatever, unless the entire empire just falls apart.
or unless Obama and the Republicans can agree that, no, really, we don't care about armed, crazy, radical Sunni men with rifles and explosives rampaging around the Middle East or North Africa anymore. And how in the hell are you going to get them to say that? Now, I think that is what they should say. I don't want to sound like I'm trying to cheer on the warfare state here. I do think that this is a serious enemy. I think the number one best way to fight them is to stop fighting them. You just heard Mitchell Prothero. He's a real expert on this. And he said, you know, it's their fight. Let Iran fight them. Iran wants to back Maliki against these guys. Erdogan wants to back the Peshmerga or whatever. Wouldn't that, hey, there's a great way for the Turks and the Kurds to start getting along. He can back the Peshmerga to help keep these kooks out of Kirkuk. Stay the hell out of there. It's a reckoning that's been coming for a long time. I don't know how long he meant. It's really the American invasion of Iraq was the original sin here. Not that I'm justifying Saddam Hussein's dictatorship, but if he had fallen by basically any other means, then there would have been, I'm not saying guaranteed what would have happened, but I'm saying there would have been so much more incentive for the leaders of the Sunni and Shia, more powerful political factions, to come to a compromise agreement over how to rule the country and keep it together, compared to the Shiites saying, well, we got the Americans to fight our civil war for us. I mean, rewind this thing a few years and look at this Wall Street Journal headline today, right? If this was 2005 and I was ranting and raving about the Bottom Brigades, this is what I'm talking about, guys. Look, America's out. In the future, in 2014, when America's out of there and Al-Qaeda comes back up again, it will be Iran that comes to put them down. Like I've been trying to tell you, that's who we've been putting in power this whole time. Iran's guys. In fact, just thought experiment, not justifying it. I'm a libertarian. The U.S. government shouldn't exist. That should go without saying, but I'm just saying. If they had gone in there, never even mind an expert sniper shot, but even with the horrible invasion regime change of the Iraq war, if they had just up and left right after that, there still would have been so much more incentive for the leaders of the various major power factions to come to an agreement than making the Army and the Marine Corps of the United States of America basically the auxiliaries of the Bottom Brigades. Again, like I was talking about yesterday, these were the, like the same with the Dawa Party, these were the Iraqi traitors who, when Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan hired Saddam Hussein to invade Iran, they fled to Iran and fought on Iran's side. And then after that war ended, they stayed in Iran until George Bush invaded Iraq in 2000, George Bush II invaded Iraq in 2003 for a regime change in Baghdad. They followed on the heels and inherited the South, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution and the Dawa Party. And Muqtada al-Sadr was the other major power faction inside the United Iraqi Alliance, but he's a working class schlub. And he didn't truck with American occupation any more than Iranian occupation in the country. So the Americans were more willing to deal with the Iranian-backed Supreme Islamic Council and Bottom Brigades and Dawa Party than with the Iraqi nationalist who was against Iran and the United States. And so George Bush had maybe your son or your neighbor's son go fight in that war, maybe die in that war, kill in that war, in order to install Iran's guys in power. Now, I mean, really, I'm of the point of view that there's pretty much no group of organized anyone anywhere with less moral authority than Al-Qaeda in the world. So if it comes down to it, I prefer Muqtada al-Sadr to any kind of wannabe bin Ladenite. Go ahead and shoot them. Now, don't torture them to death with power drills to the head, for Christ's sake. But, you know, truth is, I'm not trying to take the side of any of the Shia power factions, but from the point of view of the interests of the American people, how in the world could it have been in the American people's interests to fight a war for Iran's auxiliaries than to fight a war for the Saudis' auxiliaries? I don't know. What a mess. What a damn mess. And I'm sorry, I saw somebody complaining about all the I told you so's and this is all your faults and that kind of thing going around today. And, you know, I don't know. But it seems like there's value in that. If just to make the point that it did not have to be this way. A lot of people did told you so. Millions of people told you so. Have known better. Have given examples of good policies that could be taken instead, or at least preferable ones, all along. It's not like this is just the fate of history that has done this. It's American policy. The American democracy. The American empire.
Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, y'all. Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. ScottHorton.org is my website. That's where I keep all my interview archives. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. ScottHorton.org. And, I don't know, man. I wonder if anybody wants to listen to the rest of the show, me just reading McClatchy stories about Al-Qaeda gains in Iraq. How about this one? This is that Wall Street Journal article. Iran deploys forces to fight Al-Qaeda-inspired militants in Iraq. Iranian Revolutionary Guard forces helped Iraqi troops win back control of most of Tikrit, the sources said. Lebanon, Iran has deployed Revolutionary Guard forces to fight Al-Qaeda-inspired militants that have overrun a string of Iraqi cities, and it has helped Iraqi troops win back control of most of Tikrit, Iranian security sources said. Two battalions of the Quds Force, the elite overseas branch of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps that have long operated in Iraq, have come to the aid of the besieged Shiite-dominated government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, they said. Combined Iraqi-Iranian forces had retaken control of 85% of Tikrit, the birthplace of former dictator Saddam Hussein, according to Iraqi and Iranian security sources. They were helping guard the capital, Baghdad, and the two cities Najaf and Karbala, which have been targeted by the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, an al-Qaeda offshoot whose lightning offensive has thrown Iraq into its worst turmoil since the sectarian fighting that followed the 2003 U.S. invasion of the country. Oh, that was a pretty frank statement for the Wall Street Journal, I guess. Tehran has also positioned troops along its border with Iraq and promised to bomb rebel forces if they close within 100 kilometers or 62 miles from Iran's border, according to an Iranian army general. In addition, it was considering the transfer to Iraq of Iranian troops in Syria if the initial deployments fail to turn the tide of battle in favor of Mr. Maliki's government. The Iraqi government has asked the U.S. to carry out airstrikes and to speed up the delivery of promised weapons, which raises the prospect of both the U.S. and Iran lending support to Mr. Maliki against ISIS insurgents, who are seeking to create a caliphate encompassing Iraqi and Syrian territory. General Qasem Soleimani, the commander of the Quds Force and one of the region's most powerful military figures, traveled to Baghdad this week to help manage the swelling crisis, said a member of the Revolutionary Guards, or IRGC. Qasem al-Araji, an Iraqi Shiite lawmaker who heads the Badr Brigade bloc in the country's parliament, posted a picture of him and Mr. Soleimani holding hands in a room in Baghdad on his social networking site with the caption, "Haj Qasem is here," reported Iranian news sites affiliated with IRGC on Wednesday. Haj Qasem is Mr. Soleimani's nom de guerre. At stake for Iran in the current tumult in Iraq isn't only the survival of a Shiite political ally in Baghdad, but the safety of Karbala and Najaf, which along with Mecca and Medina are considered sacred to Shiites worldwide. An ISIS spokesman, Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, urged the group's Sunni fighters to march toward the filth-ridden Karbala and the city of polytheism, Najaf,
where they would settle their differences with Mr. Maliki. Holy crap. Well, word to the wise here, just if you look at where Najaf is on the map, I'd be amazed if the Al-Qaeda guys could get anywhere near it. Sadr's army can prevent them. Sadr can snap his fingers and prevent the Sunni-based insurgency, whoever's running it, from getting to Najaf. I mean, maybe they could sneak in one man at a time with an explosive belt or something. But any kind of assault force against Najaf, I'll believe that when I see it. It's just too far to the east for them to get to, I think. There's just too many damn Shiite militiamen. An ISIS spokesman, Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, urged the groups... Oh, I just said that. The filth-ridden Karbala and the city of polytheism. Boy, oh boy. You know, this went from... the only Sunni-Shia split in Iraq was just, well, you know, us and them. Who's who, right? Sectarian, but human, political, earthly differences. Now it's really about blasphemy. Oh, how dare you be a Shiite when you should be a Sunni, say the Al-Qaeda guys. At the beginning of the second leg of their 100 years war here. Man. The coarsely... And I'm sorry if you guys can hear the neighbor's lawnmower in the background. I think probably you can. Well, let's see. Oh, yeah, that's coming in nice and loud as hell. So certainly if you got headphones on, you can hear it. Sorry, I just... What am I going to do? People got to mow their lawns, man. Sometimes... During my show, yeah. Uh-huh. I guess I'm going to just play some music. Anyway. It'll be a nice little lawn mowing, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Iranian intervention sort of a thing. So I don't know, man. My mind is racing with all the different directions to go with this story. How about we go ahead and sign the nuclear deal with Iran tomorrow? And we go ahead, and this is not me talking, okay? This is a sane American nationalist hijacking my voice and talking. Nationalist, but not crazy. It's time to ally with Assad and Iran and Maliki against Al-Qaeda. Support the rebels against Assad. You must be mad. And, you know, Mitchell Prothero's right. There is an FSA, but come on. What was moderate about them is they're not suicide bombers. They're criminals. All right. You know, in other words, they ain't getting nowhere with anyone anyhow. The rebels, we're now in year 3 of the war in Syria. The rebels are Al-Qaeda. They're either al-Nusra, who've declared their loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri, or they're the Islamic Front, which has declared its loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri, or they're ISIS, who are just exactly like Ayman al-Zawahiri, only are in a little political power play with them, but still they have the exact same goal, creating the Islamo-fascist caliphate that never existed before American foreign policy kicked in. Now, of course, my solution is abolish the U.S. government, and then it cannot be tempted to intervene in any way. But I'm just saying, if the U.S. government had to exist and had to have a foreign policy, it would be sending in Hezbollah militias to kill the Al-Qaedaites. Right? Sorry for making sense here. How about we could start with... getting on the phone to our al... I think even an anarchist could agree to this. Both me's, left and right brain, agree with this. Before the U.S. government completely abolishes itself, they should make a phone call to the king of Saudi Arabia and say, please stop financing these guys and sending more warriors to go and help them. Thank you. That could really be a great help. And now, no, we should not be backing Assad, and we should not be backing Hezbollah, and we should not be backing Iran. We should, I don't think we need a relationship with Hezbollah whatsoever, only with the Lebanese government, which they're a part of.
But our guys can talk to their guys by way of the Lebanese government, and that's fine. I don't mean to say we need to extend any further contact with them in any way whatsoever. We certainly do not need to do like George Bush and hire Assad to kill and torture al-Qaeda guys. That's part of what got us into this terrorism mess in the first place, is backing dictators who torture and murder these type of people. It's only created that many more of them. It's only given our government the excuse to engage in even worse policies like full-scale invasions and regime changes, which has made even that many more of them. But we should just have a normal relationship with all these countries. That way we don't have to worry about the Shiite Crescent or the Bin Ladenites, because there will be no one left to support them.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement, featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more. The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty, and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to my show. It's the Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, I don't know, man. I gotta change the subject for a minute here, at least. Oh, you know, yesterday I wanted to talk about this, but I did not get a chance to. Or actually I did, but I kind of kept going on and on about different things. One of the things I wanted to say is about the constant Democratic Party, especially, push for gun control in this country. Now, the thing of it is it, especially, you always hear, you know, it's time for us to have a conversation about this. Yeah, we've been having a conversation about it all this time, and enough Americans own guns, non-political ones. Basically, 150 million Americans are gun owners. And their idea is that, yeah, it comes with cost, that we have a society where there's so many guns that people, you know, can get their hands on them. Yep, but freedom's more important. We could put a camera in every house and make sure that no husbands are beating their wives. That's the worst violence in our society outside of the police forces, you know. Is husbands beating their wives. We could have cameras in the houses to prevent that, to save their lives. To save their children. But no, we're not going to have mandatory cameras in people's houses so that government can protect us from that, because you know what? That's a line. And we're not letting them cross it, no matter whatever. It's unimaginable. We would let them cross that line, right? Right? Jeez, don't let me get ahead of everybody here, but I'm pretty sure we got a consensus on that, at least. There are limits to the power of the state to make everything perfect in our society. And part of that is we're not letting them take our guns away. And for me, I'm not really like a big gun guy, but I sure as hell support your right to own a gun. And I think that lost in all the propaganda of all sides. I mean, I examine the media a hell of a lot, as much as I can, quite a bit. And, you know, obviously a lot of people are just talking past each other, especially on the left-right divide. People are just talking past each other, not listening to each other at all. I'm trying to listen to all sides, and even the ones who agree with me. I don't see them really explaining, first of all, you know, you have a right to defend your life, ultimately, with deadly force. If it's proportional, if someone is initiating deadly force against you, then they are, in essence, ceding their right to keep living at that point. It is justifiable homicide to kill them to save your own life or that of another innocent person. That's not controversial. But so a gun, as Sheldon Richman explains on the show, explains in print in his great writings and his talkings and whatever, the gun is the great equalizer. A little old lady with a .38 revolver can protect herself from a gigantic male armed lunatic with a spiked club or an axe. In fact, that's a real case I happen to remember, where an axe wielding PCP lunatic crashed through a lady's front door in a townhome in, I think it was in San Francisco back, oh, this was a long time ago now. I don't know. And she shot him and killed him. Like, she'd have been, it would have been better for society if she had laid down and died because, you know, that by axe murder, because, you know, a society armed with guns is just too dangerous, and she should have had to apply a license. And if she didn't have a license, she should have been a felon for possessing that firearm without having prior permission from the Democrats. And what? No, 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 no. First of all, it's her property, and so you just have no claim on it at all. But secondly, I mean, any more than if she possessed PCP, that's none of your damn business either. But the point is that every day in America, every day, regular people, law-abiding citizens, are protected by their ownership of guns. And you could start with the in general, like, home invasion robberies are not much of a problem in Texas. Because the criminals don't like guessing which doors have people with shotguns on the other side of them and which ones don't. And they know that at best they've got, what, like, a 1 in 15 chance of surviving if they kick in somebody's door in the middle of the night in Texas. If you do that, you're liable to have a gigantic hole through your chest. And so that's just not a gamble that criminals take. And so we got a lot of Democrats who are free riders, you see. I think maybe they own a fee to all the gun owners for their protection, even though they're not even armed. No, I'm just kidding. That's one of the things. But also, you know, directly and specifically, people brandish firearms and or discharge them in the air and or into the bodies of assailants daily in America. Daily. And people say, oh, you can never find an example of somebody who stopped a mass shooting with a gun. Well, actually, I think there are a couple of examples, but that's not the question. The question is, how many times do people stop their store from being robbed? How many times do they protect the life of someone in their family? How many times do they protect themselves from being raped or killed by some criminal? And it's not foolproof. It's not magic. It's not a force field. But it happens every day that people tell the robber, actually, you should turn around and leave now, pal, if you know what's good for you. And the robber takes it as sound advice because the would-be victim turns out to be armed. And it's not fun to look down the barrel of a gun, no matter who you are. And that happens all the time. And there are websites like this where they catalog these stories. And they're not make-believe. There was one just the other day in St. Louis where some robbers put a gun to this girl's head and then they went into her house, or they were on their way into her house to, I guess, you know, rob the family with their gun to their daughter's head. Well, the father and mother saw what was going on out the window, grabbed their firearms, and arranged a clean shot. And the guy that had the gun to the daughter's head, he fell dead instead. And his buddy got away wounded, but was later captured. There was one just a few weeks ago, and these are just the ones that made my attention when they made the news. I don't keep track of these on a regular basis. But there was one where some muggers were having a lady at gunpoint go and rob an ATM. And a law-abiding citizen, or maybe they didn't have a gun, maybe they had a knife or something. In any case, law-abiding citizen pulled out his gun and said, actually, you're going to sit there and eat pavement until the cops come and handcuff you and take you away to protect your rights and give you a fair trial. And that kind of thing happens all the time. And so you don't hear about that in the propaganda. In fact, what happened in Las Vegas the other day, the law-abiding citizen with the firearm inside the Walmart, if he had realized that this guy had a ruthless homicidal maniac for a wife with him, he might have been okay. He might have been able to take them both. But he got taken by surprise. Because what are the odds that he goes, he draws down on the armed lunatic with a rifle or shotgun. I'm sorry, I guess a long gun. It was a shotgun, I believe. He goes and draws down on him and doesn't realize the guy's wife is standing behind him, also prepared to murder. In fact, with blood on her hands from across the street. Prepared to take his life. She shot him in the ribs, I don't know, from the side or from the back or something. But other than that, absolute one in a million chance that the guy's wife is like, you know, the robber lady from Pulp Fiction. He would have taken that guy down right there. And anyway, so, and never mind my utilitarian argument. People still got the right. You don't have the right to murder somebody. And listen, I understand that guns make it easy to kill. And it's not much consolation if someone is held accountable for a murder to the person who's been murdered with a gun. But, you know, I saw this, you know, Obamaite tweet on Twitter that really just summed it up perfectly. The gun controller's point of view on this is, why can't the pro-gun people understand that no guns, no gun murders? But of course, she just completely skipped a step and presumed that passing a law saying no guns means no guns. That's not what it means. It just means gun prohibition. It means gun black markets. It means instead of going down to Daryl and Son's rifle shop, now people who want to be armed have to go to the black market, which would, of course, then be run by the most ruthless and murderous of black market cartel kingpins, etc., etc., ad infinitum. Enough of this magical thinking when it comes to solving these problems, okay? Let's at least start with a reality of people's rights and the world we live in. Please? Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Who, me? Yeah. Hey, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Hey, if anybody wants to do phone calls, we could do some phone calls. The number's 512-271-4836. That's 512-271-4836. You can ask me questions, you can call me a jerk or criticize me or talk about whatever you want. Obviously, I'm all caught up in the gains of ISIS lately. But there's a lot going on, of course, Ukraine and everything else. And, you know, anyway. I'm like Bill Hicks, man. I get so frustrated. I never see my point of view represented, you know? So that's why I had to stop there and have my say about the guns thing. It's because, you know, you don't have to be a gun fanatic to be all for the right to bear arms, because rights are rights. You know? In fact, I saw a tweet, a thoughtful tweet from a liberal saying, you know, when I look at the history of the way gun control is applied to poor blacks in America, it makes me question whether it's really a good idea. Ding, ding, ding. Wow. You mean it's not like your fantasy where rich, rifle-owning country club Republicans are having all their guns taken away, which, you know, why would you want their guns taken away anyway? But yeah, of course it's poor black people who go away, and not exclusively, but in large measure, who are imprisoned on, quote, gun charges. Oh, he was arrested on weapons charges. In other words, he didn't do anything to anyone, but they got him for possession of a firearm. Really? How is that a crime? It's horrible, man. And, you know, it's the war on drugs and the war on guns. The liberals are more likely, at least, to understand the ridiculousness of the war on drugs. It doesn't get rid of drugs. It just makes drugs more expensive. And it turns the drug business over to people who are willing to be criminals for a living because they've got short time preferences like that. And so it makes no sense to embark upon a crusade of drug prohibition, and therefore it's no surprise when it never does work. That's a liberal talking and being smart. And maybe because
Maybe only because they're more likely to have a little bit of experience with drugs. And so instead of just being afraid by all the propaganda, they look at it from a little bit more realistic and grounded point of view. Right wingers, if they were thinking, maybe that's a big if, could say the same thing about guns. You don't want to have a war on guns, because all that'll happen is you'll drive the business underground. And it'll be just like the prohibition of drugs and just like the prohibition of alcohol. You'll make everything worse. You won't get rid of the guns. You'll just turn the business over to criminals. And the most ruthless criminal wins. Or the one who gets in bed with the CIA first, Sinaloa cartel, or you know what I mean. And so, it would seem to me like liberals ought to be able to understand these arguments about guns. And conservatives ought to be able to understand the exact same arguments about drugs. Wishing that your magic wish should become the law and then society will immediately conform to how you want it to be is just magical thinking. It's childish thinking. It's not realistic. And why in the world should someone be charged with a gun crime if it's not a crime that they committed with a gun? He was licensed to carry what? This kind of gun, not that one? Licensed to have it under his arm but not on his hip? Or the other way around? It's crazy. And the thing is, you know, I think liberals make a big mistake because they're... ultimately, they're conservatives. They're Hobbesians at heart. And the next step in their thought experiment is, oh, you think everyone should walk around with a gun getting in shootouts all day long and that kind of thing. But I'm not such a misanthrope. I think people are basically decent people. And maybe it's just because I'm from Texas and I've grown up around armed people with rifles in the back windows of their trucks my whole life and stood in line at 7-Eleven next to people with guns on their hips or under their arms or whatever in such a way that this doesn't make me that nervous. But I don't live in a society where everybody's killing each other all the time. To be perfectly honest with you, if I think at all about the danger of a home invasion, of someone breaking down my door and hurting me, or my wife, or anyone else in my family, I'm much more afraid of the police. In fact, when I talk about guns on this show, I think, wow, in the back of my brain, not that like I'm some kind of meth addict paranoid here or anything, not that I have ever possessed any meth in my entire life. It's just a figure of speech. But I wonder whether the fact that I talk about guns on the radio is a check mark in my threat matrix that says that maybe they need to send the SWAT team to my door if they ever want to come to my door because they misunderstand a figure of speech about meth paranoia. I'm actually far more terrified of them than any just home invasion robber criminals, which people do rob houses, you know. They do burgle houses more often. But, you know, there's a threat of criminals. But as far as which I would worry about first, far more afraid of the cops. And maybe that's partly just because I'm a anti-government type political activist sort. So I'm afraid, not afraid, but it occurs to me, I can imagine what they might think of me, which would probably be far out of proportion or... you know, which would be sure to be a misunderstanding of who I really am and what I'm really about, if you understand what I mean, you know? So anyway, I guess there's a whole other segment almost shot to hell talking about guns, but it seems like an important issue. And it's sad that, you know, there was a school shooting the other day and hardly anyone even noticed. It happened right before I went on this show and I didn't even mention it. I didn't have time to. There were other things going on and whatever. And fortunately, that one was more limited. I think only one kid was killed, or two, including the perpetrator. But, you know, and yeah, ready access to guns
from irresponsible kids is a problem, but it's not a problem for the law to fix by passing more background checks and this and that. I mean, it ought to be pro-gun people more than anyone else who, and in my experience, it always is. Gun people are obsessive about safety, right? Whatever happened to that? Every weapon is a loaded weapon. You never, ever, 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 ever point a weapon at somebody on the or even, you know, as you're, or wave it around, or put your finger on the trigger, or any kind of thing, as though you know for sure it's not loaded. Nobody, boy, when you're a gun person, you do not screw around with guns. Whatever happened to that? People leaving their guns around. Don't you remember being 13 and not really being able to imagine a future that concretely? What might happen to you if you really did that horrible thing? Don't you remember being a stupid kid? Don't leave your unlocked gun around your angry, you know, 13 or 14 year old. That's no argument for gun control other than by the men and women of the households of America. What the hell, guys? That's no call for the law to do anything, but that's a call for adults to take their responsibilities seriously. How the hell are these kids so armed to show up at school? The hell are their mom and dad? This is, you know, the first thing here comes to mind to me. Anyway, anybody wants to call on the show? 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. I'm Scott Horton. It's the Scott Horton Show. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, I'm Scott. This is my show. Oi, what a mess in the middle of my goddamn show. So anyway, it's my show, Scott Horton Show. The number if you want to call in, it's 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. If anybody wants to call in the show, or if, I don't know. Yeah, that's really for if you want to call on the show. You can join up the chat room if you want to. The chat room is scotthorton.org/chat. scotthorton.org/chat. All right. Well, so yeah, this is my show. Let's see. I'm on the list. What did I say where I'm on the list now? Oh, is this something about the guns? Man, I ain't dangerous, hell. Anyway, I'm Scott. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, I'm not really prepared for the show today. I guess I'm just going to read more about ISIS here. That's all that really matters. Muqtada al-Sadr calls for new force to defend Iraq religious sites. That's from DailyStar.com out of Beirut. Najaf, powerful Shiite preacher Muqtada al-Sadr, who led the once-feared Mahdi army militia Wednesday, called for the formation of units to defend religious sites in Iraq. Sadr said in a written statement he was ready to form peace units to defend the holy places of both Muslims and Christians in cooperation with the government. His call came after Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki said the government would arm citizens who volunteer to fight militants following the fall of Iraq's second-largest city, I think they mean to say, Mosul, and a swath of other territory to jihadist Sunnis on Tuesday. Sadr's involvement in the formation of such units would almost certainly be unacceptable to Iraq's Sunni Arab minority, members of which are also deeply mistrustful of Iraq's Shiite-led government. Before he suspended its activities in 2008, Sadr's Mahdi army, once estimated to have up to 60,000 members, played a role in the country's Sunni-Shiite God dang, apple juice. Sectarian conflict. Bloodshed in Iraq is now running at its highest level since 2006-2007, the height of that sectarian conflict's conflict in which tens of thousands were killed. So, again, I think a lot depends on whether the ISIS guys really try to butt their head up against the Shiite wall that is Baghdad now. I don't know. And maybe they are still penned in. I was talking with Eric Garris from Antiwar.com earlier, and I was wondering to myself about how come, even in the height of the Iraq war, and even though I was talking about my earlier smarts where back then I would say, well, what happens when these guys go home back to where they're from and maybe eventually come here? And as Bush has turned this part of Iraq into Gladiator Academy. I plagiarized that from somebody, but I used to say that, you know, 10 years ago, that this is a giant, lawless, Wild West jihadistan in the Anbar province in the Sunni triangle of Iraq, and there's going to be consequences, but I didn't care. I mean, I was not worried like I am worried now, so I was trying to parse in my own damn stupid brain, well, how come I was not worried then, but I'm worried now? I think then because I thought of them as a much smaller percentage of the Sunni fighting force than they apparently are now. And also because back then there was a Syria and a Turkey there to keep them out of Europe. Now there's just a Turkey there to keep them out of Europe. And in fact, they have direct access to the Mediterranean Sea. Or at least, I don't know if they control the beach at any particular time. They have it sometimes. And so that, I don't know exactly what all that means, but it seems like they could get out of there. That's an escape route for them, basically, into Europe. And then what's really bothering me is the number of Western Europeans who have gone to Syria to fight. And that was really not the case in Bush Jr.'s Iraq war. That has been the case in Obama's Syria war. And so that's the thing that's really got me bothered here. Well, and also, hell, I mean, the Islamic State of Iraq is now a place. So that to me, just, you know, thinking ahead a little bit, I don't know how long we can go. I saw Wolf Blitzer tweet that he was going to have an hour-long special about the crisis in Iraq here. I don't know how long before the truth just completely dominates the falsehood in this discussion. And the mythology that Bashar al-Assad is the greater evil from an American point of view than Al-Qaeda suicide bombers is going to fall away. And then that will be, in other words, them coming to grips with the truth that, hey, we have a giant, not lawless, Wild West jihadi stand. We have a law now. We have a jihadi state. A real jihadi stand. The Islamic State. You heard Mitchell Prothero saying, hey, I'm going to just start calling it the Islamic State. Right? Just like the Shiite part of Iraq that America ceded to the Dawa Party and the Ayatollahs is called the Islamic Republic of Iraq. Well, this is just the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, of Iraq and the Levant, or Iraq and al-Sham, which is supposed to include Jordan, too. You know, the Levant, that's a region, not really a nation state. How long for the King of Jordan? Place your bets. And the thing is, once the suicide bombs start going off in Europe and or the United States, I mean, isn't it just a matter of probabilities when we have this many guys? Damn it, and that was what I was supposed to get to Prothero, and I kept talking and talking and forgetting what my damn question was, and that is how many, man? I know he brought it up only to say he cannot report the numbers, but damn it, report the numbers. Give me a good ballpark. How many thousands of these guys are we talking about now? 10,000? They seem to be, you know, proving what Michael Scheuer just said the Friday before last on this show, which is this movement is run by serious guys, well-educated guys, professionals, accountants, lawyers, doctors, elders, accomplished gentlemen in their society, and they know what they're doing. And the fact that they've been whooping your ass, America, for 10 years ought to go to show that. It's not just the absolute stupidity of Bush and Obama and their governments and their government's policies. As Jeff Huber says, I'll never get tired of quoting this. Jeff Huber wrote shortly before he died that Osama bin Laden was dead and loving it. That he was more accomplished than any general in world history without an army, without a navy, without even the ability to move himself. He was able to move armies across the face of the earth to do exactly his bidding and create this mess. And, you know, never mind any of our resentment against that son of a bitch for what he did to our side and for how well he's done in making America wound itself this whole time by falling into his quicksand traps and radicalizing new generations of fighters and all of this. When the future historians look back, they're going to agree with Jeff Huber. This humorist, this cynic, got it right. Sad to say, America blew it, and perhaps they've only just begun to blow it now. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, you guys. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Wish I could stop time for a minute and do lots of different things at once. Anyway, this is my show, Scott Horton Show. Anybody wants to call in the show? Well, you can do that. The phone number is 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. Scott Horton. ScottHorton.org. I've been working on it. I'm making it better. I got a bookstore now that it's only about half full, but I'm trying to put as many books as I possibly can think of to recommend to you. Many of which I've read. I don't know proportions. Many of which I've read and would like to recommend to you, and others of which are on my list for I sure hope I get a chance to read one day before I'm dead. But anyway, it'll be a whole big bookstore, and then, you know, hopefully whenever we interview guests about their book, we'll be able to direct you there to buy your copy and that kind of crap. So working on that. Also working on Scott Horton. Oh, that's at scotthorton.org/books. It's not even half done. But anyway, that's where it is. And that's where he's saying. That's what I'm saying. And then also, boy, I can't read and talk at the same damn time, can I? Also, scotthorton.org/stickers. scotthorton.org/stickers. That also is just brand new. But what I want to do, see, libertystickers.com, I invented it a long time ago, and I've made up a lot of those stickers over the years and whatever. But I sold to Rick back 10 years ago. It's his company, and he's got a lot of stickers in there that aren't the ones that I made up and that kind of thing. But, you know, I still get a nickel or so every time he sells one. So what I was thinking was I could build a site of my own of all of my stickers and then have them linked back to his site for you to buy them from him because what do I want to do more work? And then maybe that way that would help be an extra little bit of incentive for me to make up more stickers all the time. And then when I make up more stickers all the time, then I'll sell them and make more nickels. I love me some nickels. So that's at scotthorton.org/stickers. Also, there's a documentary section that's already there. Not that I've ever made a documentary, just they're everybody else's documentaries that I like and would recommend to you. That's at scotthorton.org/documentaries. And what I'm going to have, too, is a documents section where I need to get the right plugin where I can embed PDF files on my regular WordPress page. But then I want to go through and why not, right, post all the COINTELPRO documents and all the Waco documents and all the torture documents and all the World War documents and all the everything documents, right? The crisis of democracy by the Trilateral Commission. Whatever you got, man. Yeah, the crisis being that there is some democracy. We gotta put an end to people power right now before it gets out of hand. Yeah, man, that's what I want to do. We'll have scotthorton.org/documents. And we'll have all the PDFs of every PDF that I want to copy and paste. And there's a way to do that now, right, in WordPress. Where you can, actually embed PDF files right there into your plain old, regular old HTML page. Oh, glory day! And then, you know, I just want my place to be a place where you can go to find things that may disappear someday. You know, I got a little fair use section to scotthorton.org/fair use where it's some of these articles that I think are really important. And as far as I know, they only exist like one place on the internet that I'm not sure is going to keep existing. And so I just want to make sure. Like, there's this great article by this guy named, I can't remember, but the article is called What Bodies? And it's about how in the first Gulf War, when they got to Kuwait, they said, hey, where are all the dead bodies of all the Iraqi soldiers? And then the answer was, well, we buried them alive. Buried them alive in their trenches. Just drove by with tanks with bulldozer blades on the front and buried them alive in their trenches by the thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands. Because, you know, conservatism and all that. Surrender not good enough for the USA. Not never. So anyway, that's an example of the kind of article you can find in the fair use section there. A lot of great documentaries, Iraq documentaries, Vietnam documentaries, World War documentaries, and a couple of Afghan documentaries, Israel-Palestine issues, and a few other things there. So, and I really am trying to get, it's so hard for me, but I really need to get back into blogging at the Stress blog. That's scotthorton.org/stress. I mostly just post what's going to be on the show today. But I always mean to get back to that, to participate in the comments there more, and to make scotthorton.org more of a place where people might bookmark it and homepage it and hang around. But anyway, you know, I was pleasantly surprised to see in the Alexa rankings, I'm like number 50. And to me, you know, the Stress blog especially, my website in general, is a ghost town compared to what it used to be. And so if I'm number 50 now, then that means that I must have been, used to have been doing a lot better than that. And I think that means that I could be doing a hell of a lot better than that right now. So, go ahead and bookmark me over to scotthorton.org. I keep all my audio there, whole show archives, interviews, blog, documentaries, chat room, and all the rest there at scotthorton.org. So hang out. How do you like that? Big commercial for my own goddamn site. Cool. And by the way, patronize my sponsors. They like it when you patronize them. And I like it when they like it when you patronize them. So, there's another little thing that I ought to say more often. All right. Boy, I got a lot of things to do right now. And my show ain't over yet. All right, now let me see here, man. Iraq asking for U.S. airstrikes against al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda tears down Syria-Iraq border. Map where ISIS is gaining control in Iraq and Syria. U.S. plans emergency arms shipments to Iraq. Baghdad in their crosshairs. Iraqi army flees. Here's what I wonder. If they do march on Baghdad or try to, is the Iraqi army even going to put up a fight at all? I mean, the Iraqi army is the Badr Brigade, right? So they'll fight. They're mean sons of bitches. But then again, I don't know. 30,000 flee. That was a headline from Prothro's article here. 30,000 troops flee their posts. Out in the Anbar province. Although, you know, I do think that they will stand their ground there for Baghdad. It is, again, a Shiite city now. So, you know, it's not like they're going to just be able to walk right in like they did in Mosul. And by the way, there are apparently, you know, 500,000 refugees hitting the road immediately already fleeing from ISIS. Just because they don't have the capacity to fight against them doesn't mean that they like them. But man, I got to tell you, when they're bulldozing that, you know, earthen berm that marks the border between Syria and Iraq, I got to wonder whether that's ever going up again. Not that there's anything holy about it, but I'm just saying, boy, oh boy, it's almost like the wall coming down. This is the history of the world right here playing out before our eyes. It's been sort of a lull, at least as far as the coverage has been concerned. But now things are picking back up again. And I sure hope that Prothero is right that, I mean, I certainly agree with him that we have no real, we should not go to war here. It would only make things worse, etc. But I hope he's right that DC feels that way and is going to keep feeling that way. But I think it's just a matter of weeks before the pressure is on Obama enough that he's going to have to send in fleets of drones over this. Maybe sooner. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. God dang, I'm hungry, man. Will this show ever end? I'm so hungry. I got leftover pizza in the refrigerator, I think. That's where it was last I checked. Hurry up and end, show. Hey, man, if you guys want to call in the show, you can talk about how I'm the greatest radio show host ever, or you can talk about how I'm the worst one ever. You could talk about any of the wars or foreign policies or police state stuff, or I brought up guns today. You could talk about guns. You could talk about, hey, Scott, how come you never interviewed this guy or that lady or whatever you want, man. Call in the show. 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. I really would like to make this show a lot more about calls instead of nobody ever calls. I know you're out there listening, but you don't ever call. Maybe you're all very shy. It's true that the precedent is set that I talk a lot and oftentimes over people. But I try to be nice. 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. Call the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. And, yeah, so I don't know, man. I do have a whole ton of stuff to talk about here. Other than ISIS, I just hadn't gotten to it. But let me talk to you about Gareth Porter the Great. Gareth Porter the Great, why, he's the author of the book Manufactured Crisis. The true history of the Iranian nuclear program and the Israelis and Americans lying about it and pretending it's a nuclear weapons program and that it's some big deal that somebody has to do something about. Which is a bunch of crap. That's not the exact subtitle, but it's pretty close. So, it's a wonderful book. If you heard the show, I interviewed Gareth 10 times. Why? 10 chapters. And I made a whole damn series out of the whole damn book, man. You can go back and find it at scotthorton.org. It's also blogged at the stress blog, scotthorton.org/stress/interviews. But yeah, man, he's the best. And he just wrote a couple of new articles I would like to direct your attention to. First of all, in truthout.org, leading alarmist on Iran ignored what he knew was true. And that's in reference to David Albright of ISIS. No, not the Al-Qaeda suicide bomber kooks, but the Institute for Science and International Security. And David Albright, the quote-unquote fraud, in the words of actual, with little asterisks around it, actual physicist Gordon Prather. And Gareth Porter proves here, I guess the term in social sciences is not proves, it's shows. Gareth Porter here shows that David Albright is a damned liar. And that when David Albright tells lies, he knows he's lying. He's not wrong. He's a liar. And the proof is, he said the truth before, and then he started telling the lie that contradicted the truth. Oh, you're busted again, David Albright. Leading alarmist on Iran ignored what he knew was true. Reads the headline at truthout.org. Gareth Porter at his best, demolishing David Albright, the hoax artist, pretend nuclear physicist, pretend
IAEA weapons inspector, who was never either. How U.S. policy on Iran came to be based on fabricated documents is the headline from the second Gareth Porter here. This one is in The Nation. And this is, again, about the smoking laptop. And yeah, my laptop, blah, blah, blah. Hey, this is really important. Oh, no, I got a burp. Hang on. Whoa. Quick reflexes there. So, the smoking laptop is the best evidence that anybody's ever shown of the Iranian nuclear program. The problem is, it's a total fraud. It's just a collection of forgeries manufactured by the Israelis. And Gareth Porter has, again, shown that to be true repeatedly. For Antiwar.com, for Interpress Service, in his book Manufacture Crisis, and now here again for The Nation. Where did the U.S. get the laptop? Well, where did the U.S. and its allies and the IAEA get the so-called alleged studies documents? From the Mujahideen Khalq, communist terrorist group front for the Israeli Mossad. And as Gareth Porter has put it on this show in the past, you kind of got to give him credit because you can see how the documents represent, you know, pretty damn good educated guesses on the part of Mossad about what some of these documents might look like. However, issues later came up that showed them to be fraudulent. For example, supposedly they were working on a delivery vehicle for a nuclear bomb or a warhead, a nuclear warhead, to fit in the delivery vehicle at the top of a Shabab missile. Little did they know, it was already being redesigned in secret. So it made no sense that the Iranians would be designing a nuclear warhead payload for an obsolete missile when they had a new one. But you could see why it was an easy mistake for a foreign government's intelligence agency to make. And there are many other examples. Go and read Gareth Porter the Great, who destroys all arguments about Iran's supposed nuclear weapons program that actually never was any such thing. And it's great fun reading him taking down David Albright, too. All right, I'm Scott, and I got at least one call coming in here. 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. And you, sir, are on the air. How's it going? Oh, wait a minute. I'm an idiot. Hang on one second. Okay, now you're on the air.
Okay, hey, Scott. It's good. From San Francisco.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for calling in.
Good fun. Yeah, appreciate the show as always. Yeah, unfortunately, don't have too great a topic, but I just finally finished a book that unfortunately took me, you know, close to a year because I've been through about three or four other books that you had recommended on in the way of getting through this one. But one guy, I think you might have had him on years ago in the past, but Mark Mazzetti, his book Way of the Knife was a pretty informative one on how the CIA just had basically taken control of the military to a large extent, although I think probably while he was writing this, JSOC started doing more and more at the same time, too. But I thought that was I just wanted to recommend that one. It's a good one, and it just shows at the same time how incompetent both CIA and the and JSOC was on some of these things, with and they're basically just, yeah, you know, their fight for more power and more action, basically, in order to justify more power, more money.
Right. Yeah. I have it here on the shelf, and I desperately want to read it. I just wish I had more hours in the day, but it seems like it's sort of the little bit more mainstream companion book to Jeremy Scahill's work. And I guess I've heard it, his book Dirty Wars, I've heard it referred to as, you know, surprisingly candid and well done for a book written by a New York Times reporter. But then again, I've always actually had respect for Mazzetti. Not that he's perfect, but I've noticed, you may have heard me point out on the show before, I noticed that David Sanger always does a better job when Mazzetti is his co-author than when he's writing with William J. Broad.
Yeah. But anyway. Yeah, I guess you completely ignore him, yeah, when he's partner with Broad. So.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Although at the same time, Broad does, he's actually done a couple okay pieces when he's not with Sanger. So.
Right, yeah, I noticed that too. So you're just like me, man. No wonder you like the show so much, man.
That's how it goes.
No.
All right. Well, yeah, no, I really want to read that. And yeah, I guess that covers really the... Does he talk about Libya in there? Scahill basically sticks with Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia.
Yeah, he sticks mostly with Afghanistan and Pakistan. You know, he does a little bit of Libya in there, but you know, a lot of it just stateside for the internal bureaucracy. No, it's a lot. I wouldn't. You know, I definitely would recommend Scahill's over this. You know, for the big picture, but it's got some funny little like anecdotes in there, like one. There was one where, like, Cheney, like, back when he was a congressman back in the 80s, was visiting Delta Force's compound. And they were, you know, this is the late 80s, and so this is pre-Google and everything. And apparently they had, like, their early LexisNexis type thing. And they were showing, oh, so you first the computers? And like, yeah, well, put my name in there. And they put Dick Cheney in there. And they came with a story, like, from some Midwestern paper on how the congressman there was going against Cheney on this bill coming up. And Shane was like, wait, what? And he gets on the phone and calls that congressman like straight there from Fort Bragg and starts, you know, tearing his congressman, you know, to the point where all the Delta Force guys are like, let's leave him alone here in this room, you know.
Yeah, they're all scared of Dick Cheney. That's funny.
Yeah, and that was back when he was just a congressman. But anyway, it's got some funny little stories like that, and also on how Leon Panetta was a complete, you know, completely lied to the Pakistani intelligence about that that Green Beret that killed all those guys in the street. Yeah, so he.
All right, we're out of time. Thanks, man. Appreciate you calling.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, see y'all tomorrow. Thanks for listening.